So, Mayo, we have some housekeeping to go over before we get started today. We've done Apple Podcast subscriptions for a while, where you can pay us $5 a month or $50 a year for an ad-free version of the show. But I think we're going to expand that a little bit with 9 to 5 Mac Happy Hour Plus. So this, in addition to ad-free episodes every week, you'll get pre- or post-show content every week, some monthly bonus episodes, and unlike Apple Podcast subscriptions, which filters out chapter markers and chapter artwork, our native 9 to 5 Mac Happy Hour Plus will give you chapters and chapter artwork and all of that. So still $5 a month, still $50 a year, but a lot more content.
I was going to say, you're getting more for the same price.
More for the same price. You can't argue with that.
This is the marketing brain right here. See?
Aren't you an economics major? Aren't economics majors notoriously bad at marketing because they just look at the numbers?
I guess so. Well, I'm looking at the numbers. I'm saying economically, it's the same price,
but you're getting more stuff.
There you go. So there you go. Buy it now. And we are planning to wind down the Apple Podcast subscription side because of the feature limitations. So if you're subscribed over there, you can subscribe here and you'll get all the same plus more. And you can roll with it.
Yeah, so just to reiterate the marketing part again, still ad-free versions of every episode, special private conversations between me and Mayo before or after each episode. And
which we didn't do on the Apple Podcast subscriptions, but we're going to start doing.
Yes, the Apple Podcast subscription was just ad-free. So again, all of this extra content, same price.
And you're supporting us directly.
Yes, indeed.
Which obviously we're very appreciative of. We have a fair number of subscribers in the Apple Podcast version, but we'd love to obviously build it out, have some more, and maybe even add some more stuff over time. So for now, we will be having the first post-show exclusively at the end of this episode, if you subscribe, where we'll be talking about social media and TikTok specifically.
And my personal experience with TikTok and trying to wind down the usage of TikTok, but we'll get more into that for the members. We can tease some other stuff I think we might talk about. We might talk about Mayo's adventure learning how to drive for the first time, some various other Vision Pro tidbits, all of that. Maybe my experience, I'm about to move. We might talk about some personal stuff to do with that. I think it'll be a good mixture of personal, but still a lot of tech.
Yeah, I'd love to mention some random apps and stuff that we don't normally.
Yeah.
Because normally the shows are news centric, right? It's like talking about the stories of the week. And we're not going to get rid of that. That will still be carrying on. And however you listen to us, we appreciate it. But yeah, extra stuff. 9to5mac.com/join.
Then also at 9to5mac.com/join, you'll see 9to5mac Daily Plus, which is my other podcast that Mayo's appeared on a few times. I'm also doing an ad-free version of that for $5 a month or $50 a year. And you will get some monthly bonus content there as well.
And if you really love us, you can go all out with a big old bundle and you can get Daily and Happy Hour for a reduced price in one go.
$8 a month or $80 a year for both of them. Again, the economics on that, Mayo, I think that sounds pretty good.
That sounds pretty great. 95mac.com/join.
Indeed. So, news this week. A couple weeks ago, we talked about Apple's decision to remove progressive web apps or iPhone home screen web apps in the European Union. They said it was because of the DMA's requirement that browsers have feature equality. Basically, they couldn't come up with a way to give third-party browser engines the ability to do home screen web apps in a secure and privacy-friendly way, at least in a timely manner. And
yeah,
they
could do it if they wanted could. To and invest the engineering resources, but they obviously decided that not many people use PWAs on the iPhone, so it wasn't worth the engineering time. And I think internally to Apple, right, they're mad that they have to do any engineering work for the law. So they've already done quite a lot to support the third-party app stores things and the alternative browser engine stuff. We spoke about, you know, a couple of episodes ago where they are being accommodating of things like JIT performance for JavaScript and stuff on these third-party engines. So, you know, they've acted in pretty good faith in conforming to the law in the technical aspects. Obviously, the business structure and the alternative terms are more complicated. But generally, I think from a technical engineering side, they've been pretty good. This was where they drew the line and like, we're just not going to bother to do that. So because of what we understand the DMA to mean, we can't offer it to anybody in the European Union at all. So no more home screen web apps for you. which was particularly problematic for people that were using home screen web apps before, and then they were going to update and they'd stop working. Mm-hmm. And so you could have apps where they were using like local storage to store information, you know, just like a native app does. And then if they're in the EU, they'd update to 7.4, the home screen web app would just turn into basically a bookmark to open inside of Safari, and all of that functionality and all their stored data would be lost. So it was kind of a rough awakening for people that actually did use them. So it wasn't a great situation, but that was the situation.
And Apple has seemingly heard that feedback and said that home screen web apps in iOS 17.4 in the European Union will exist as they do today, regardless of any DMA changes or anything. So nothing, basically all of that conversation and nothing is actually going to change.
Yeah, everything they said before is completely irrelevant.
And I think if we're choosing to not be cynical and we're choosing to maybe give Apple the benefit of the doubt, reading between the lines, it sounds like Apple thought it couldn't offer WebKit home screen apps in the European Union because of the DMA's rules on the browser equality stuff. And maybe they just interpreted the guidelines wrong. And after the pushback, either they went to the DMA or the European Commission came to them and was like, hey, you can do this. It's fine.
Yep.
You misread the guidelines, sir.
100%. That's like the DMA is not a prescriptive bullet points of stuff. It's just like very general because they're trying to accommodate more than just one specific business issue, right? So they're trying to encompass legislation for the monopoly gatekeepers, quote unquote, of Apple, Google, Facebook, you know, Instagram, WhatsApp, individual apps, you know, other services, Microsoft, like anybody that's big, Office. They're trying to incorporate all into one set of legislation, and so the legislation is not App Store owners must allow for this, and they must allow for an alternative browser engine to power web apps available on the platform. Like, it's just not written like that. It's like, it's basically sums up to be like, you must be interoperable and give other people as much access to your platform as you get yourself in these areas. Okay, go and do that. You know, like, it kind of leaves it wide open for interpretation. And the EU's even admitted it. They're like, the way we like to work is, here's what we want to happen. We're going to go and see what the companies do. And if we don't like it, then we'll tighten down and, you know, have follow-up enforcement action. And in this case, it wasn't follow-up enforcement action. It was more like the nice side. It was like, well, you've interpreted this really strictly. We don't actually care about this part. So you can just do what you want before and you'll make your customers happy. So yeah, obviously there was some kind of like back channel communication after they announced, because Apple wouldn't have removed the feature on purpose, because when that happened, there was the conspiracy theorist line of, well, this is just another example of Apple trying to force people into the App Store by making PWAs no longer exist on the Apple platform. That just wasn't congruent with the facts of Apple's actually been making the PWA feature better and better over the last few years. Like, they could have easily just ignored it and abandoned it, but they've actually made it better and better. They maintain it. They added features that literally last year they added push notification stuff. So they've been improving it. And I mean, on the Mac, with the most, you know, with Sonoma, they literally added the best thing ever, which is the web apps in the dock feature, which is basically PWAs for the desktop too. So like they haven't only served themselves in privileging native apps. Obviously, they do privilege native apps more, but they haven't, like, you know, kicked PWAs to the curb. If anything, they've got more investment in that than ever. And this was like them basically being like, look, the law is kind of forcing our hand here, so we've got to turn it off. Sorry. And then it was like, well, actually, your lawyers maybe interpret this wrong. The EU's basically given us, without officially saying it, they've basically said, no, it's fine. So now we're back to normal and the feature can carry on as ever. So it's good change, but it's like a perfect representation of the DMA in action, which is kind of this kind of amorphous, ambiguous rule set that different companies are trying to work out what they need to do. And at some point the EU will tell you yay or nay, but the deadline is literally this week and a lot of stuff is still very much up in the air. We don't know, like, all the stuff Apple did to support alternative app stores, the core technology fee, the alternate business terms, all of that stuff is still in the unacknowledged zone of Apple's done it, but we don't know if the EU is going to be happy about it.
And I think two things can be true at the same time, right? The DMA can be kind of a vague, messy piece of legislation that can also encourage Apple to do good things or things that it should have done years ago.
Yes.
So we're not saying the DMA is awful, horrible, shouldn't exist. It's just, we are kind of learning.
I don't know if I agree with everything the EU believes.
Right,
but
yeah.
But there is clearly a need for someone to rein in Apple's, like, 15 to 30% commission dominance on everything that happens on the iPhone, in one way or the other. We can have conversations for literally ever, and we've done it before, and we'll probably carry on, about exactly where that line should be. But if Apple has demonstrated that if nobody draws a line, they'll just keep everything to themselves. And on the biggest single computing platform on the planet, which is the iPhone, feels like they can't get away with that anymore. So you need some court, some kind of government oversight to get them in line. I don't know if the DMA is right on a lot of things. I especially think like the browser choice screens are stupid, but there we are. Now we've got them in the EU. But the wider points have some merit. And I don't know, if I was a lawyer, I'm not sure that coming out with a law that specifically specified you must do this, 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 and this would be very effective either, because then you get a different class of issues. So coming at it from this perspective is maybe more flexible and better for the long term, because both companies and the EU can see how stuff is interpreted and can see kind of the problems come up and, in a perfect world, react to it accordingly. And this is kind of that. Like,
kind of.
It kind of sucks for Apple's PR team, because they took a load of, you know, they took a load of brunt and backlash for having to announce something negative. But then the EU was like, look, guys, we don't actually care about this, so you can just carry on offering that same feature as you always done through Safari. And Apple was like, great, here we go. And now we move on.
iOS 17.4 with all of the new features in the European Union, like alternative app stores and alternative browser engines, and all of that is now available. Other than all of the EU stuff, there's not a whole lot. There's some changes to CarPlay, Apple Podcast transcripts, which we've talked about. Anything else worth mentioning? It's really the EU update, basically.
There's like five emoji.
Oh yeah, the new emoji. The head shaking horizontally, the head shaking vertically, the phoenix bird, the lime, the brown mushroom, and the broken chain.
And what isn't new emoji, but they've changed, you know, the family emojis where like two adults and a kid? So previously they were all like rendered as like man, woman, child, or, you know, different combinations of that, but they didn't have skin tone choices. And there wasn't obviously every single combination of family, because that would be like a near infinite list of stuff. So there's been a long running debate in the Unicode Consortium about what to do about this. Back in like 2020, the idea was, well, you're going to add like 7,000 different emojis, each for different combination of family unit. And that was turned down because the device manufacturer, like, this is untenable, this is way too many images for one category. So what they've landed on with the new release is basically just make the family emoji really generic and kind of abstract. So if you look on your phone now for the family emojis, they use that like symbol style, which is just like that blue box with a white, you know, cutout in them. And so now you get like a blob for a parent and a blob for a child together. So if you liked having an actual picture of a family, like people that look like people, this update isn't really for you. But it's just a funny thing. I don't think they had a better way of solving it, because adding, like, it's like a combinatorics problem of, like, if you've got a three alignment and you've got to choose skin tones for each person and different genders for each single person, you literally end up with, like, tens of thousands of combinations. So for, you know, a different way to approach the inclusivity issue is just to basically make them look like not people at all and just have a very iconographic representation, which is what they've gone with.
One other thing in 17.4 that I don't think was in the beta, or maybe it was in the beta and nobody noticed it, but there's an update or a new finance kit feature that's pretty cool. If you use a budgeting app, there's ones like Copilot, Monarch Money, the You Need a Budget. Previously, to integrate Apple Card, Apple Card Savings Account, and Apple Cash into those budgeting apps, you had to basically export all of your transactions as like a spreadsheet, a CSV, then manually import that spreadsheet into those apps. So there's no support for like real-time import of new transactions. So if you used your Apple Card to purchase something, that transaction wouldn't appear in your budgeting app, unlike if you used an Amex or a MasterCard or Chase card or whatever. But in 17.4, Apple now lets you go through like a link process in these apps, to where you just link your Apple Wallet, your Apple Cash, Apple Card, Apple Card Savings Account directly to the app, and then real-time transactions are supported. So it's actually a really well-done feature. And I think, based on my conversations with some of these developers, they'd been asking for this for a while, and Apple basically had no interest in doing it. because they had integration with Mint, which was the most popular furry budgeting service kind of in the world. Mint shut down in January. So that meant there were no budgeting services that supported Apple Card integration. So then they hastily put this together and it works pretty well. I tried it out. I use Copilot, tried it out in Copilot and works great. Super easy.
There's way too many services called Copilot at the moment.
That is true. That is very true. I do think this Copilot was first, or at least well before Microsoft Copilot, but yeah.
Yeah, and while we're still in the reign of the DMA news, you obviously had the Epic Games situation.
Because
Epic Games previously announced that they were going to launch a third-party app store in the EU to host Fortnite and other games. Apple supposedly had given them a developer account to use to do this. And then this week, it was revealed that Apple has revoked the developer account. So now Epic Games cannot launch a store again because Apple took it away.
And Apple's explanation is that Epic basically applied through an automated process for a developer account in the European Union, and there wasn't any human review. Apple basically got wind of this and was like, whoa, 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 the automated process should not have approved this company that has violated the developer terms in the past. Cut them off again? Is that what happened here?
But didn't Tim Sweeney release emails between him and Schiller that were dated like middle of February? So it seemed like they've been like Schiller said, can you give us your assurances that you will act in good faith here? And Tim Sweeney was like, yes, we will. And then there was like a gap. So I guess Epic was like, well, Apple's happy. And then like a week later, they got the lawyer a message being like, no, mate, get out of here.
Yeah, I guess so. This is on, I don't know, this is on Apple in the big picture, I guess. But Phil's email is kind of funny, putting aside any sort of regulatory problems or anything like that.
Because
he says, more recently, you have described our DMA compliance plan as hot garbage, a horror show, and devious new instance of malicious compliance. And you have complained about what you called junk fees and Apple taxes. Just, Phil has the receipts of things that Tim Sweeney tweeted that he did not appreciate.
Yeah, but that can't be used as justification for blocking them access to make a third-party app store. I mean, that is ridiculous.
And there is the question of, so what Epic or what Apple is leaning on here is the ruling that came as part of the big lawsuit between Apple and Epic in the United States, where Epic violated the App Store guidelines, circumvented the in-app purchase process, all of that. And one of the outcomes of that case was the judge said that Apple is rightful in terminating Epic's developer account. And that's the argument Apple is using in this decision to terminate Epic's developer account. The question is whether that applies to the developer account made by Epic Games Sweden in the European Union. I'm not a lawyer. I don't know if you can use rulings in the United States to justify something you're doing in the European Union, but I'm sure.
Yeah, I don't know the legal ramifications of this. I mean, clearly Apple's lawyers have one interpretation of events. But we know from the EU DMA situation that Apple's not allowed to filter third-party app stores on reasons of content, right? Like, they have to allow emulators, they have to allow pornographic apps, they have to allow, you know, illicit content, they have to allow like pirate video services. It's not up to Apple to filter that stuff out. They're not allowed to. But then apparently they can be like, well, we don't like you, Epic, so all your content's not allowed. So like, I don't really understand how that jives together, but that's currently where we are on that, which is just a weird, funny thing.
The last thing on the emails that Epic Games released here is the first email on February 21st was sent from someone at Epic to Craig Federighi. Or no, the first email was February 16th, sent from someone at Epic to Craig Federighi. Then they followed up on February 21st to Craig Federighi. Then it looks like either Craig Federighi just didn't respond or just forwarded the hate mail on to Phil Schiller and said, I am not dealing with this, which is just a funny interaction. An interaction between Craig and Phil.
Phil that doesn't really work there anymore, but still does.
Clearly is playing a big
Apple
role.
The Apple Fellow deals with the Epic Games court case. That's the Apple Fellow role at the moment. And then finally, with the EU stuff, Apple got slapped with $2 billion fine in the music streaming case that we talked about before. In a previous episode. So this is the case that Spotify has like driven, and they filed like formal complaint in 2019. The EU gave formal charges about a year and a half ago, and now they've finally given their ruling, which is basically you're getting a fine, Apple, for illegal App Store policy, around the anti-steering provisions, and then you're also not allowed to anti-steer people anymore. Again, there's a lot of ambiguity here, so...
Shocking.
Obviously, the rules of the App Store have transmogrified and adapted over time, and the when this investigation was first opened, the rules were way more restrictive than they are today. Like, the redirect rule about links to account management or contacting your customers to email them, those kind of things were not in the review guidelines in 2019, but they are now. So it's unclear to me whether the rules as they stand right now, you know, the current App Store review guidelines, if Apple does comply with that, with the EU ruling on this competition case, or if they actually, or if the EU is also demanding further changes. I couldn't get an answer one way or the other.
Yeah.
Spotify seems to think that the EU is saying that now Apple's not allowed to control messaging inside of an app at all. And so they're trying to submit an app update, which basically just lists all of their pricing and links to the website to buy it, i.e. more than one link allowed by the reader rule, right? And Spotify seems to think that the EU is saying that that's fine now, it's open season. We don't know. That so far, that update hasn't been approved by Apple. So again, this is a drama that will carry on. Happy Hour this week is sponsored by ZocDoc. Download the app for free at ZocDoc.com/happyhour. Everyone loves to treat themselves, whether it's buying extra legroom on a plane or going to that fancy coffee place rather than making it at home. And just like you don't want to compromise on treats, you don't want to settle when finding a good doctor. It's your health after all. Enter ZocDoc, the place where you can find and book tens of thousands of top-tier doctors, all with verified patient reviews. Don't settle. Go for the best and find the doctor right for you. ZocDoc is a free app and website where you can search and compare highly rated in-network doctors near you and instantly book appointments with them online. We're talking about booking appointments with thousands of top-rated patient-reviewed doctors and specialists. You can filter specifically for the ones who take your insurance, are located near you, and treat almost any condition that you're searching for. And the average wait time to see a doctor booked on ZocDoc is between 24 to 72 hours. That's it. Once you find the doctor that you want, you can book them immediately with just a few app taps. You can even nab same-day appointments. Simple, fast, and no more awkwardly waiting on the phone to a receptionist. What a great idea. If I needed this product, it's what I'd use. So go to ZocDoc.com/happyhour and download the ZocDoc app for free. Then find and book a top-rated doctor today. That's ZocDoc.com/happyhour. ZocDoc.com/happyhour. Thanks to ZocDoc for sponsoring the show.
New 13-inch and 15-inch MacBook Air powered by M3. Pretty much exactly what we were expecting for these new MacBook Pro models. Just an update to the M3, faster Wi-Fi with Wi-Fi 6E, upgraded neural engine, available to order this week and start shipping tomorrow, actually, so March 8th.
Yeah, the reviews are out.
I think benchmarks show it's exactly what we were expecting based on previous benchmarks from the M2 to the M3.
Yeah, I mean, they'd already released an M3 laptop last fall with the M3 MacBook Pro, the base model, right? Because obviously you also have the M3 Pro and M3 Max, but the base model M3 MacBook Pro, performance characteristics are identical to this MacBook Air.
The big change that stole a lot of the headlines is that this MacBook Air, for the first time since the Intel days, can power two external displays at the same time, so long as the MacBook Air lid itself is closed. So two external screens, but you can't use the MacBook Air screen at the same time. But this is still one regression compared to the Intel MacBook Air, right? Where you could use two screens with the MacBook Air screen.
You could use like four screens on an Intel MacBook Air.
Really? And the MacBook Air screen could be open.
Yeah, you could plug in loads of screens. Like, you couldn't do it at 4K, right? They're specifically talking about two 4K, I think, or two 5K displays in clamshell. But, like, a lot of businesses don't use 4K or 5K displays, right? They just use 1080p garbage stuff. So you go into offices and there can be, like, three monitors right there. And any Intel Mac would do that. Now you can't do that unless you get the Pro or Max Apple Silicon models. This is a step in the right direction because... Mm-hmm. Now, if you are using clamshell on a desk, you can have two monitors work and not just one, which is great and everything. But it is technically still a regression to... it's like the only thing that Apple Silicon Macs are worse at than Intel machines is, for whatever reason, the way their display controllers are set up, the silicon on the chip, the way it's just designed, the display controller's bandwidth is just way less. So you're limited. You only get two on the base model chips, and it would take a pretty significant uplift from them in terms of both like chip design and like the power consumption to make that work, I think, which is why now we're in the third generation and it hasn't changed. But at least this, because what this seems is more like just like a software workaround. They're like, look, we can't change. This computer can only output to two screens at once. Modulo, you know, those like display link kind of hack things you can do.
Yeah.
Okay, you can only output to two screens at once. But what we'll let you do is basically if we shut off the laptop screen, we can redirect that display controller now to an external instead. Which kind of matches how the Mac Minis have done it, right? Because
right.
The Mac Mini is all the base model M1, M2 Mac Mini has supported output to two external screens because it has no screen of its own, so it had support for two. On the Airs until just now, the one of those lanes was always reserved for the internal display, but now they've done some trickery to make it so the lane can switch and also go out of a HDMI port or a USB-C port, whatever, external.
And this obviously brought up the question of, okay, if the M3 MacBook Air can do two external screens at the same time, why can't the base model M3 MacBook Pro that we got in October do the same thing? Turns out it can. Apple says a software update at some point will enable two external screens for the M3 MacBook Pro, again, so long as the lid of the laptop itself is closed. I think that kind of corroborates that this is just a software workaround of some sort that they've either finally decided to open up or finally figured out how to open up.
Some people did some investigations, and the physical display controllers, like connections, are different between the M1 and the M2 and the M3. And so there's a belief that maybe this software trick could also work on the M2 generation, but it wouldn't work on the M1 generation because of the way the stuff, like basically where the lanes go. They couldn't redirect it. So maybe it was possible in the M2, but it wasn't possible in the M1. And it seems like the M2 and the M3 design are the same. And maybe sometime last year, someone had this idea where they were like, wait, we could actually use this differently and then actually give people a feature. And that's why it kind of accounts for the weird, like, not ready for the M3 last fall, but now it's ready. So here we are, kind of timing on it. Obviously, it would have been better if this was ready to be announced with the M3 MacBook Pro in October, but it wasn't. But now we're here, and they're giving it to both machines. So overall, thumbs up. But yeah, it's kind of just awkward how they didn't have it ready for the quote-unquote Pro model at the end of last year.
Having to have the lid closed on the MacBook Pro model does suck just a little bit because of how great that screen is. But if you want two screens, I guess it's a good trade-off.
Yeah, and a lot of people have a lifestyle where they use the computer clamshell on the desk, and then when they use it off a desk, they can then get the benefit of the internal display, right? So I don't think this counts. I don't know percentage wise, but this accounts for a lot of the people who were previously divorced from the Apple Silicon world because they wanted to be able to output two screens, and your only option before was to pay a lot more money. Because before, you'd have to go up to the M3 Pro, the M2 Pro chip, right? So you'd have to go up to $2,000, basically, to get more than two screen outputs, to get more than one screen output on the laptop. And so now you don't have to do that. You can just get an Air, which is the same price, by the way. They didn't put the price up on the M3 generation. So it's the same price. And now you can do two screens at once. So it's consumer friendly, but it's still a slight gap between what the old Intel machines could theoretically do. Because if you have three 1080p displays, you're still going to be out of luck. One of them won't work.
So with that, the current state of the MacBook Air lineup, the 13-inch M2 MacBook Air is still an option, and it's dropped to $999 in price. Then, like Mayo said, you have the 13-inch M3 at the same price, $1099, and then the 15-inch M3 at $1299, same price as before. What's missing is the M1 MacBook Air, which officially is gone. So no more wedge-shaped MacBook Air options. We now start at $999 for the M2 with the new boxier, flat-edged design.
I know some people miss the wedge thing, and I do kind of have a fondness for it, but the M2 design overall is way better as a machine because you get the nicer screen, the bezels are thinner, you know, you get the kind of notched thing at the top. It is thinner overall, but obviously not at the thinnest point. The thinnest point of the wedge was obviously thinner than the average thinness of this thing. of the newer generation. But like, I'm so happy because that M1 Air was getting pretty dated. Like, just fashion wise, it didn't look as modern. And because the bezels were the bezels were thicker and it just looked older. And now it's gone. And they finally got the $999 price point as a modern looking laptop, right? Yeah, it runs the 1-year-old chip, but it's otherwise the same. I mean, there's not really much else new on the M3 other than the slight performance upgrade and the Wi-Fi. So now if you want to go and get out and get the M2 Air, I think it's a great option. $999 price point is very strong. People criticize the base storage and the base RAM. I know it would be better if they were higher, but I don't think it's untenable. It's pretty legit. I'd buy it as a second computer if I needed one. So yeah, M2 Air at $999. And the M3 starts just a couple hundred dollars more. And you can get in 15 inches. Like, great lineup.
There's always the people and always the analysts who are saying the 15-inch MacBook Air isn't selling as well as Apple had hoped or that maybe it should sell. But I see a lot of them. I hear a lot of people talking about how great of a machine it is. And I think with the new support for two external screens, it's even better. I think that, more than anything, will probably dissuade people from buying the 16-inch MacBook Pro now. Because there probably were not an insignificant number of people who were buying the 16-inch MacBook Pro, even though the 15-inch Air existed, just for that extra external screen support. So the 15-inch M3 Air is a kind of a good default recommendation for just about anybody. And I don't think it's surprising that they discontinued the 15-inch M2, because there's not really room in the lineup for that.
Yeah, it's similar with the iPhone, right? Where they don't keep the Pro models around from the previous generation. It doesn't have any signal as to whether it sold well or not, right? It's just they just don't keep every single model around. And I think, however well the 15-inch sold, it's clearly not the most popular option. The 13-inch is the most popular option, naturally. I think the 15-inch, purely anecdotally, sells decently enough for them to keep doing it. I think it didn't get the pent-up demand rush when it launched that I think maybe they're anticipating. And so the supply chain was like told to hold off for a bit while they just got through the inventory. But day to day, I think people are buying it. So yeah.
The M2 MacBook Air 15-inch launch was also just, remember, it was so weird and it had supposedly been ready for months and it wasn't announced till WWDC, just a weird launch altogether. But yeah, good MacBook Air lineup right now. So I wanted to do, Mayo, a Vision Pro check-in. Because it's been out for about a month, a little bit more than a month. And we talked a lot about it when I got it the week after it was released. And in the intervening weeks, there's been the stories of returns, people saying they wouldn't buy it, people saying they've kind of stopped using it, they aren't using it as much as they did during the first week. Our friend Parker bought one, returned it, caused a massive storm of other people saying they returned it, causing headlines on The Verge and Bloomberg saying people were returning it. Then he bought another one. So that's just an interesting
little... And now he says he really likes it again.
Yeah, now he says he loves it. So it's proving to be a not divisive, but kind of just different launch than anything Apple's done recently. It's not like an iPhone.
I think there's a lot of variation, right?
Like, yes, yes.
Because it's so personal to you with fit and stuff and just what you can do with it. You can easily, and people have different benchmarks for value for money, and
yes, obviously
it's an expensive product. So depending on each individual person, you can get a very different sentiment.
It's not like an iPhone where you upgrade and then you're going to keep using your iPhone like you used it before, because A, you have to, and B, the iPhone is like a commodity at this point where you know how you use it in your life and you can't live life without it. So you're not going to return it. Most likely you're not going to return it. You buy it and you use it just like you did before.
It's more like a Mac Studio, right? Where it's more expensive. It's more niche. Some people love it because it fits what they need and it does what they need. Other people might have bought the Mac Studio when it first came out because of the hype train around it. And then they realize, well, I don't actually really need that thing, so I'll just go, I'll just get rid of it and get a Mac Mini, or I'll just carry on with a laptop-only lifestyle. Like, the Vision Pro has Pro in its name. Like, it isn't a... It obviously had a big splash because it's a new product category, but it is a niche area. And so you kind of combine all of the, what am I going to use it for? Will I use this? Oh, I've bought one because the ads were cool, but I never actually found a utility for it. Okay, we'll come back in a few generations' time. Combined with fit And yes, that, again, is very personal. And if it fits you well, if you can get it to feel comfortable, then you can use it for hours and hours. If when you put it on, it hurts you too much, it's too heavy on your head, whatever the reason, you're just naturally going to want to return it and not use, or not use it very much. And so it's very individual in that way.
The fit is kind of where I wanted to start my check-in here is, I feel like I kind of hit the jackpot in that it fits me, at least fits what feels like perfectly. When I wrote in our notes that the fit and comfort is like a 9 out of 10. And when I wrote that, I was using the dual loop band, and I'd basically got it down to a science. I could take it off, put it back on, have a pretty good fit almost instantly, maybe a little bit of adjusting, a little bit of adjustment required. But I've actually been dabbling with the Solo Knit band the past week or so, and I think I actually like it quite a bit. The biggest difference for me between the Solo Knit band and the dual loop band is how much easier the Solo band is to adjust while you're wearing it. So if you're wearing it for 3, 4, 5 hours in a row, the dual loop band, if you start to feel like the pressure on your forehead slightly or on your cheeks, it's easy to adjust, but you run the risk of kind of messing it up and having to start over the fitting process. The Solo Knit band, you just turn the dial on the side and it's tighter, it's looser, you pull it up, you pull it down. You don't have two straps to manage. I think the flexibility of the Solo loop in that regard is kind of winning me over. Because I know when we talked about it initially, I was like, the Solo loop hurt right away. I've used the dual loop the entire time. But giving it another shot, I think I actually prefer the Solo Knit band, which I found interesting.
It could still be lighter though, right?
Oh, it's still very much a 9, 8 out of 10 for me, and much lower for other people. And you definitely feel it on your face. You definitely feel it on your head.
Yeah, of all the negativity of the product that's been out there in the community, the thing is, some of it is like really easy for them to solve, right? Or, you know, straightforward. Mm-hmm. Next generation, yeah, you make it 25% lighter, 25% more people are going to be suddenly go from negative reviews to a positive review on it just on weight. So there are quirks and niggles and complications, but overall, I was pretty impressed with how positive the response to the Vision Pro was, and some of the issues are not obstacles of unknown solution. They're just things, right, that like are obviously going to be rectified with a couple more generations of hardware.
Something else I've been doing more than I was doing when we first talked about this is using Vision OS itself instead of falling back to Mac OS.
Yes,
because I talked a lot about how great the Mac OS external display support feature is on Vision Pro. And it's still great. You are still wrong, Mayo, about it not being a good solution or not being a good experience. It is a great experience.
I mean, I've never used it, so I didn't say it wasn't a good experience. I just said, if I had one, I don't think I'd use the Mac display part.
Well, anyway, what I've been doing is, I mean, I've just been using it sort of, I mean, it's so much like an iPad.
You should use the actual native apps with the native experiences, and you can put Windows, yeah, wherever you want.
Mm-hmm.
That's what you should be doing.
Yeah. That is, yeah, that's what I'm doing now. It's
great.
I don't understand your point here. Are you trying to say I was wrong about the macOS display thing, or
no? I think at least in your week one comments on it, you were like, the Mac Virtual Display is like the best feature of the hardware, and I don't think that was true.
I don't know if that's what I said. I said, without the ability to fall back to macOS, it would be a less appealing device, which I still think is true.
Based on your early impressions, it sounded like to me you were going to like live in the Vision Pro and like just slap a Mac display up in the middle and then carry on using all your apps on the side. And I haven't actually asked you, but I imagine that use case hasn't played out.
It hasn't. Not to the degree that I don't know if it's to, not to the degree, yeah, that I
think,
thought
I think
it
we're kind of both right, but I was right.
Okay, well, I still think the macOS, okay, so here, there are people in other reviews who have mentioned they find the macOS screen feature in Vision Pro like unusable.
Yeah.
Blurry to the point that it's a bad experience. And that is just not true, at least for me and at least some other people that I've talked to. It is good. It's a great feature. But yeah, I'm not living in it 8 hours a day using the Mac feature like I was the first week.
Yeah, it's not the center of the product. It's, yes, the fallback or convenience if you really need it, I would say.
But using Vision OS itself, like I started to say, it's a lot like an iPad, but it's kind of all of the good features of the iPad with the guardrails removed.
It's an iPad on steroids.
Yeah, exactly. You can place the windows wherever you want. You aren't restricted in how big, how small those windows can be. You can still run iPad apps alongside native Vision OS apps. You have really good trackpad keyboard control. You have the macOS fallback option. The limitation for me at this point is the app situation.
Mm-hmm.
So when we talked about it a week after launch, I said that the writing app that I use, Obsidian, wasn't available, including the iPad app. I don't know if I was wrong or if they released it a little bit later, but now the Obsidian iPad app is available on Vision Pro. And it's fine, but when you're like manipulating text, editing text, adding links, you know, all of the things you do when you're writing a story, the lack of optimization for Vision Pro and Vision Pro's interface, whether that is the keyboard, the trackpad, or hand and eye gestures, it kind of really shows its face a little bit.
Yeah. Like, you're going to hit the iPad, the unoptimized iPad apps don't have the additional affordances for hit detection. They aren't thinking about, like,
exactly
a one-hand gesture kind of environment, right? They're thinking about direct interaction. So they can have smaller buttons. The eye tracking, they're not even thinking about making sure they've got enough gaps between the items. Like, the Apple developer documentation says for Vision OS apps should have 60 points of padding, but like that's how big a button should be on Vision OS. On the iPad, it should be 44. So like, and they scale it to try and like accommodate, but at some point, the buttons on iPad apps are just smaller than they should be for a perfect Vision OS experience. Combine that with the gestures and the weird like assumptions that an iPad app makes that a Vision OS app doesn't, because it's just designed differently, and you get the situation where it's just not ideal. And especially for things like text editing, where you got to like make that menu pop up and drag the lollipop handles around to select stuff, and like you can see how that would be ungainly.
Luckily, there is a really good native Vision OS text editor called Runestone that I've been using. It's a good example of taking an experience that you are used to on your Mac or another device and kind of bringing it to Vision OS without changing too much of the experience. It's still familiar, but it has those Vision OS polishes and touches that you kind of just hinted at.
I mean, Apple's not a great role model here, because most of their apps are iPad apps only. Like, I mean, talk about text editors. Pages is iPad app only, for instance. And they haven't released any, right? It's been a month. There's been no change on that basis.
No changes. So,
yeah. Maybe they're waiting for Vision OS 2 in the summer or something, but
there's also just apps that aren't available at all from Apple. Like, there's no Find My app, for instance, which is just a weird limitation, and it sounds like one you wouldn't notice, but if I'm wearing Vision Pro and like getting some work done in the evening waiting for Emily to get home, I'll oftentimes check her location to see if she's left work yet so I can start dinner, or I can feed the dogs, put the dogs out, and get some stuff done before she gets home. But I have to pull my iPhone out and look at it to check her location, which is just a weird limitation. Like, at least give me the Find My version, or the iPad version of Find My. Also no weather app, which is weird, at least from Apple. But
the weather thing is like
calculator.
I can imagine them wanting to, because you know, like, the weather app on the iPhone is kind of standalone in that it has like all those full screen animation stuff that like no other of the Apple apps do, right? Mm-hmm. Like, because the iPhone apps is as immersive as you can get for a weather app on the iPhone, right? It's like full screen animations, the rain like falls off the boxes, you know, like you get the splashes and all the water droplets and stuff, like. And they brought that to the iPad too. You can imagine them for Vision Pro. They want to like make it so like it rains in your actual room. You know, like go full immersive space experience for a weather app. And they haven't done anything. So you can't even get the iPad app, which to me implies that they're working on a native app and they don't want to release the iPad app in the meantime. Maybe I'm wrong about that, but that's kind of where I judge that one. So I wouldn't be surprised if Weather was one of the native apps they've been working on and it just wasn't ready by the time it came to ship.
Yeah.
So they just didn't ship it at all.
Using Vision OS itself instead of falling back to the Mac kind of shows the limitations of the M2 chip and the 16 gigabytes of RAM, and the sort of just the base level of what Vision Pro is doing, at least I think, is significantly higher than what like an idle iPad is doing.
Oh, 100%. So, like, 3D rendering.
Yes.
The Vision Pro is doing all the time. Even if you're just showing 2D windows, they're being rendered in a 3D environment.
Right.
Updated at 90 times a second. Mm-hmm. The iPad can get away with being 2D in almost all contexts. And if you're not touching the screen, the iPad can do nothing at all in many cases, right? Because it's like you're just looking at static screens. Vision Pro stuff is always moving or being composited. Like, all the Vision OS apps are all blurry backgrounds, right? So they all show the pass-through experience behind it or the mm-hmm. environment or whatever else. So, like, the base level of work that the Vision Pro is doing is way higher than a Mac or an iPad, 100%. And some of it is given off to the R1 chip to handle.
Right,
I think specifically merging of the pass-through cameras and the IR sensors. I think all that stuff is handled on the R1. But the raw rendering of, like, the scene, I'm pretty sure it still happens on the M2 chip. So base RAM usage and base CPU, like idle CPU usage and GPU usage, has to be higher than on an iPad, I would imagine. Which then means the constraints of 16 gigabytes of RAM are more impactful than on a Mac, which I think is what you're trying to get at, right?
Exactly, like, yeah.
Yeah, a 16 you can do less on a 16 gigabyte RAM M2 Vision Pro than you can on a 16 gigabyte RAM MacBook Air.
The other day I had the NBA app going. I was watching a Pacers game, and the NBA app on Vision Pro is, like, really good, really immersive. Like, has you can put the bars on either side, showing stats and expectations for the game, field goal percentage, all of that stuff. Then I had, like, I think I had Threads and Safari and Twitter open, and I think I was in Slack doing something, and just kind of had these windows all around me, and gradually things just slowed to a crawl. Like, eye tracking was basically not working. Scrolling in an app was, like, not working. I went to the home view to swipe between the grid of apps, and it would get, like, stuck halfway between two pages. Just, like, couldn't get all the way to the other page. Even after I force quit all of the apps, it still wasn't quite right. Still couldn't swipe on the home view. So I just had to force reboot it all the way.
I wonder, in part, there might be, like, a memory leak or something in the operating system that even if you close all the apps, it still kind of persists an issue. Because it still seems like VisionOS 1.1, 1.1, whatever number you're on, it's a brand new system, right? So it has more bugs and stuff than the mature macOS.
I'm definitely rebooting it at least once a day, some days too.
Oh, really? Oh.
Because I should say I'm on the stable 1.0.3, I think. And one of the reasons I'm rebooting more often is there's a bug with the environments to where it just, you turn the dial and nothing happens. You just stay in pass-through mode until you turn it all the way towards you would be 100% immersed.
The 100% mark.
And then it's just blackness.
Right, so the black rendering of environments bug apparently is fixed in 1.1.
Okay, it is. Okay, good. That is good.
Apparently.
Because that is one of the reasons for my reboots. It's just trying to reset that.
How many environments are there again?
Four? No, there's like seven, maybe.
But is that including the stupid light ones, or is that the actual, like, environments?
There's, here, let's see.
Because you got the moon, you got Mount Hood, you got the other mountainous one, which can't remember the name of.
The Haleakala Mountain, Yosemite.
Haleakala, yeah.
Joshua Tree, Mount Hood, White Sands, and the Moon.
So five.
One, two, three, four, five, six. Six.
Six, okay.
So and then, you have the other morning light, spring light, fall light things that just kind of augment your pass-through environment with different shades of colors.
And I never hear anybody talk about them, so I assume they're stupid.
Nope. And then there are the two other environments coming soon that don't have names yet. So once those come out, we'll be at, what, eight?
And still coming soon in the latest 1.1 beta, by the way.
Indeed.
So. No, coming soon, but not that soon.
I saw somebody say that those can be, like, unlocked or added remotely, like, without a software update, so maybe.
Like, downloaded.
Maybe they'll do it with 1.1. Like, server side, but yeah. That kind of was my next point, is the environments are still gorgeous, and I still love them, but you kind of lose interest in them gradually, mm-hmm. and you grow to appreciate the pass-through mode quite a bit. And I think it would be different, obviously, if apps could share their environments with the system. So if I could sit on Tatooine and Disney Plus and kind of have my VisionOS windows around me. The Marvel environment in Disney Plus, or no, the Disney Theater. That's my favorite one. If I could sit in the Disney Theater and just do everything in VisionOS, that would be A+, 100%. But you can't do that.
I watched a video on the Disney Theater environment the other week, and it is really cool. And like, they have like noise of people talking, but then when you start playing the film, the lights go down and everyone shuts up. Like, what a nice little detail. And it just shows that, yeah, there's so much potential. And either Apple needs to like hurry up and release more environments at the system level, or they need to find a third-party integration system where apps can contribute back.
I certainly don't think it bodes well for the fact that there are two environments coming soon and they're already on the home view. It's like, those are going to be the next two. Then how far off in the distance are the next two that they aren't shown on the home view, or they haven't been previously announced, you know?
Yeah, I mean, I feel like after the next two come out, it'll be like VisionOS 2.0 before you get more new environment stuff. So like later this year.
The pass-through is, it's still, like I said when we first talked about this, not as good as I remember from like my WWDC and January demos with Apple. But the pass-through is passable. It works. You can see, the biggest benefit for me in pass-through mode is just being able to like see the dogs and see what they're doing and not be like completely cut out from the world.
Do the dogs know what you're doing?
I don't think they have any idea what they're... I think they think I'm asleep. Because if I'm sitting on the couch... So we have Blake, who's our black lab, right? And if she wants to hop up on the couch and sit with you and she knows that you're awake, she's going to wait for you to like tell her to hop up and lay with you. But if she thinks you're asleep, I've noticed since wearing Vision Pro, she like very... very sneakily puts two paws up on the couch, then puts the rest of them up, and it's like very gentle because she doesn't want to wake you up or whatever. So when I have Vision Pro, and I'm pretty sure she thinks I'm sleeping.
Meanwhile, you're peering at her with the eyesight demon eyes.
But there's a thing with VisionOS and Vision Pro in general where your brain just kind of learns to adapt to what Vision Pro is showing you. So that includes pass-through mode. That includes like the field of view. You just kind of adapt to live with the limitations, and at a certain point you stop noticing that, okay, my field of view is different than what it would be normally.
And I guess it happens both ways too, where you get used to the limitations, and stuff that was really impressive on day one, you're also like, well, that's just table stakes now.
It's the norm.
We just expected to work like that. Yeah.
The one thing that I still notice every time though is the glare on like the screens when you're in a dark environment watching a movie or a TV show or a YouTube video or something. And I think I said when we talked about this the first time is that that's the single biggest annoyance for me. And that's still true. I have not gotten used to that.
Yeah. And it for people sucks. Who don't know, that's caused by the lenses. So yeah. The screens are like pristine and perfect, but obviously to magnify them to your vision, they have to take a 1.5-inch OLED and make it look really big. And so they use pancake lenses, which are thin, quite thin lenses, but they have a load of good properties in terms of reduced color fringing and chromatic aberration and stuff. But one of their known downsides is they cause internal reflections. And the Vision Pro is no different. You get the internal kind of glare reflections, which if you're in a normally lit scene in the daytime, the glare's probably still there, but you just don't really notice it, right? Because it just kind of blends in. But if you're in like a dark environment where it's mostly black, any reflection will then make the black look, you know, it will stand out on the black background, which is probably one of the reasons why Apple doesn't offer like a full black environment. Like, there's no way on the Vision Pro to get full black. Like, the closest you get is kind of on the moon. And even when you're in like a theater environment, they make it so there's like software rendered reflections of light on the floor and stuff. Like, I think part of that's for the immersion. Part of it's also just to kind of cover up the glare issues. But obviously it's there. On that problem, I don't know that there's an obvious solution. Like, I could easily see Vision Pro version 2 come around and the glare is exactly the same, because as far as I know, the pancake lenses that they have in there are like the state of the art. And there's not a better lens they could put in there to stop that from happening. So I don't know what's going to happen on that one.
Am I right in that it's similar to like how you get the reflection, the lens flare, when you're taking a picture on your iPhone? Like, you know, the dot.
Similar. Yeah.
Similar.
There's Yeah, it's along the same kind of lines.
And they haven't solved that, and it's been a problem for years at this point. So I think you might be right. It's an insolvable problem right now.
Yeah, I mean, the lenses in the iPhone don't have... That's slightly different because they're not pancake lenses.
Right.
And it's like the light of the sun is so bright that, like, you know, you can't stop it without making the image quality worse overall. Pancake lenses, I'm not a lens expert, but that, as far as I know, they're like the best lens of all the possible options at the moment. Like, there's different trade-offs to each,
yeah,
but pancake's the best. And it's not like there's like a pancake lens version 2 that's like, well, next hardware can obviously use this next better improved lens. This is like where we are at the moment, and all the headsets that use pancake lenses have this kind of situation, and no one's solved it. So I'm sure there's ongoing research and development, but there's not a clear path to a solution there.
The reason I wanted to do this like 1 month check-in is just to point out that I'm still using it. I'm not one of the people who has stopped using it and has kind of found it collecting dust on the corner of my desk. I'm still using it. I use it. I really don't think there's been a day since I got it that I haven't used it.
You use it every day? Wow.
Because I think, so it, like you said at the start, it's a very personal device. Everybody's use cases vary. I am married to someone who is going through graduate school and has a lot of homework, a lot of work. She works a lot. She's got her own stuff. She has to do a lot. I have a lot of time to myself, you know, if that makes sense.
I'm very aware of that lifestyle.
Yeah, you're very aware. But so I just have lots of opportunities, especially in the evening, to like put it on and watch a few episodes of a TV show or watch some YouTube. Or I work and Emily is at her work, at her office, and I can put it on then and not be cut off from her and not impact the time I'm spending with her.
And I think it speaks volumes that even a month in, you still feel compelled to watch YouTube in the headset rather than watch it on your laptop or on the TV or on your phone. Like, that's a huge commendation.
The best way I think I can explain it is just kind of explain a normal, like, quote unquote, night for me and Emily to a degree. Like, she gets home, we have dinner, we spend a few hours together, then she has to go off and either do homework or she likes to just read, like, casually and read her book and stuff. So then I find myself with a few hours to kind of do whatever. And we have, like, a spare, like, den slash, we call it, like, the bonus room, kind of, that just has, like, a TV, a couch. And the TV in that room, I don't think it's been turned on for, like, 3 weeks at this point. Because if I go into that room to watch something, I just put on Vision Pro. Like, why wouldn't I? It's such a better experience than sitting there looking at a TV, scrolling on my phone, kind of half watching, half not watching, when I can just kind of put on Vision Pro and kind of direct my attention to one thing. And if I want to go check on Twitter or Threads or whatever, I can do that on Vision Pro. I just find it to be a far better experience and a far more relaxing experience.
And so I guess you're not even using the theater environments, right? You're just kind of just putting the windows up wherever you want.
It depends on what I'm doing. Because, yeah, when you're in the theater environment, you can't open other windows like in around you. Like, you're in the theater environment. You're looking straight ahead. You're watching the screen.
Which is something they should change, I think.
I think so. Well, I don't. I kind of like
even if they don't make it like a system environment, just make it so if you're in like the Apple TV theater, you can open your Twitter app or your social media app on the side.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. Like you put it well, the fact that I'm still using it all every day, a month in, is, I think that's like the line. Once you cross that line, you've kind of integrated it into your life and you're not going to stop using it. You're no longer just using it because it's new and shiny and different.
Yeah, a month in's enough to know like you've got legitimate uses and the novelty's gone, right?
Exactly.
So that's cool.
Maybe we'll do another check-in in 6 months and see. But I keep thinking about in 2022, 2023, I did a whole lot of travel. Like 2022, I was traveling once a month, basically. And if I would have had Vision Pro in 2022 to do all of that, to travel with, I would be asking Apple to put me in commercials and let me talk about how great this product is. Because I do think travel is going to be so much better with this. And I do have, I think, some travel next month, hopefully. So that'll be my first true test of...
Yeah, I can't wait for WWDC to see what they've got ready for VisionOS 2.
Yep.
There's so much more room for the software to get way better. Like, they started from a decent position for a 1.0 operating system, but there's so much more stuff that is obvious. Whether it's just more apps, you know, different ways to organize the apps, navigation, more gestures, like, so much stuff that is even you know, the low-hanging fruit. There's so much low-hanging fruit for VisionOS, which they can happily start working their way through the to-do list.
I think we'll maybe hopefully see some stuff in VisionOS 1.2, because 1.1 kind of seems focused on bringing VisionOS to parity, at least to a certain degree.
Know. That's the thing. VisionOS 1.1 brings it to parity, and it makes like the personas a bit better. We don't know yet whether they're planning feature releases, right, for like 1.2, 1.3, 1.4. Depending on the scheduling of the software, they might just be like, we've been literally rushing to get the release version out, and the 1.1 version out kind of fixes the bugs and the crashes and stuff from the 1.0.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
We don't really have the bandwidth to do feature releases before June. So like, I can imagine that by now they're kind of all, like, I don't know, but I'm just guessing that the VisionOS engineering group probably going to dedicate most of their attention to getting VisionOS 2 ready for beta in June at this point.
Finally, this week we have, Mayo, some actually kind of exciting Apple TV Plus news.
I was going to say, we haven't had a TV Plus corner on.
And this is a fun one. This isn't about Apple messing something up or how bad the TV app is. This is a fun one.
Yeah.
Apple TV Plus has 50 more movies than it had last week, only for like the next month, though. You want to tell us about this one?
And US only, by the way. Periodically, they have put like some catalog movies on the service as like a limited time promotion. Every time they've done it before, it's been like, they'd bring out like The Greatest Beer Run Ever, which is their original movie. And then alongside it, they'd bring out some kind of similar theme movies. That was like a war movie. So they had a couple of other war movies come out at the same time as being like, if you enjoy this, then you'll also enjoy this stuff as like a perk. So it was basically just like promotional. And it was only like, you know, 5-10 maybe for like a couple of weeks. Then they'd go away. Then there'd be a month of nothing. And then they'd bring out another original film and there might be some more. And they kind of did that on and off through 2022 and 2023. And then it kind of since I think the last one was like the middle of last year, and then they did none of it. So I was like, okay, they've given up on that experiment. But randomly, last week, they launched this brand new section on the TV Plus tab, which is called Limited Time Great Movies on Apple TV Plus. And they have disconnected from any title content that they're, you know, their own originals. They've just got 50 movies that are pretty good. Like, you've got they're not just like 50 garbage movies that, you know, no one's ever heard of. They're like name brand older Hollywood movies, right? You've got Wolf of Wall Street, Mad Max Fury Road, Titanic, loads of stuff. All available to stream for a limited time. So about half of the 50 expire at the end of March, and then the other half expire at the end of April. Obviously, TV Plus has been originals only focus since it started, right? And this doesn't change that, because the key point is limited time. But it does kind of show that maybe there's value in having back catalogue content, because a lot of people seem quite happy that now there's this 50 movies they can watch. Some of them in 4K, a lot of them in 4K, and some of them available in 3D to watch through Vision Pro as well. And as long as you have a TV Plus subscription, it's all free. It's all free to watch. I don't get the strategy, though, of doing limited time stuff like this. If they're going to add a catalog, like when they were doing the promotions with the originals, it was like, okay, this is just a promo marketing push they can do for each of their originals for like the premiere of the originals. So I was like, well, it's kind of silly, but I get why they're doing it. This is like, here's 50 movies with no real through line or connectivity of just, here's 50 movies you probably quite like. And now they're free to watch with the TV Plus subscription for a while. But because they're only there through March and April, and then they go away, are you going to build, like, habits? Like, is someone going to decide to carry on subscribing to TV Plus because temporarily they got to watch some films in March alone? I'm not so sure. And you're not going to build, like, the customer retention, I don't think, because, like, if they're not there all the time, people just won't have they won't be like, oh, okay, I can watch something here and then I can come back the next day and watch something else. Like, the level of engagement over time is not going to go up by only having limited time stuff. So I kind of feel like, although this is an interesting, I'd still this count this as like an interesting experiment. I think long term, if they think this is valuable, they should actually acquire the catalog content and just list it. Because the kind of limited time run stuff just doesn't have the sticking power, I don't think.
I don't think it has the sticking power, especially when there's no guarantee there will be another limited run next month or the month after. If they can guarantee that they'll do a 50 movie drop like this every month or every 2 months, then that's more appealing than like randomly waking up and there being 50 movies in March and then they're all gone with no sign of more movies the next month, you know? If it's a regular occurrence, like the drop model is kind of cool.
Because like you don't want to be like someone, go and subscribe, go and tell your friends to subscribe now because they can watch this stuff because they'll watch like two and then the time will run out and then they'll be gone again and you don't know what's coming next. I also think it's interesting that ever since all the back catalog stuff they've done of this nature is all movies. It's not shows because I think their pipeline is way stronger on TV shows. They just release more TV shows. They got a bigger number of original TV shows. On movies, they're still quite limited and they are doing the bigger releases now like Killers of the Flower Moon, Napoleon and stuff. But they're like one every 3 months or so. Do you know what I mean? Like having a back catalog of movies from other studios helps build out the collection because, I mean, they have 50 movies now because of this Great Movies collection. I think in total, the originals, they only have like 20. do you know what I mean? So they're like more than doubled their library just by doing this. So they have a bigger problem in terms of going originals only on film rather than TV, at least so far.
There's no like direct tie to any movie on Apple TV Plus right now as to like why they did this, but maybe it could be just them trying to get more eyeballs on things in general now that they have Killers of the Flower Moon, Napoleon, Argyle, all of that stuff. It's like, come check us out, and while you're here, look at these great movies we've made ourselves too, you know? Like, come watch Wolf of Wall Street, but then, hey, check out Killers of the Flower Moon while you're here.
Yeah, because it's DiCaprio, right? Yeah. It's weird, but it's also like, I kind of feel like it's like an experiment. They're like, if we get good engagement on this stuff, maybe then we'll be like, well, maybe we should have a back catalogue after all. the all originals thing we should just get rid of and just start putting films on there. Because the other problem with doing this limited time thing is, ring the bell, the TV app isn't set up for it, right?
So here we go.
All of these 50 films are in one row on, you know, one carousel on the TV Plus tab. So like, if you're coming to the app, there's no way you'd find this stuff. I like the chance of you just randomly encountering the free stuff you can see without seeing stuff that you can't see is like 1 in 100. And if you're just a random person who doesn't really know what's available and what's not, as soon as you see a film that's buy or rent and you're not in a mindset of buying or renting, you just want to stream stuff, as soon as you see that buy button, you're closing the app. You know, like you just give up. So if they can commit to doing a catalog full time, then they can make the tabs at the bottom actually go to movies and shows you can actually watch all the time. Right now, it's like a kind of hack onto the TV Plus tab. So if you know it's there, if you read 9-5 Mac or whatever, it's like, great, you know, here you go. You click here, you scroll down here. But if you want like filtering by genre, filtering by character, filtering by actor, it's all going to be a big muddle and mess with the store tab stuff. So there's a long way to go. I think they're kind of doing, this is the biggest trial yet I've seen where it's like, now I could actually see them doing just back catalog content full throttle. And so maybe they're going to do this March and April. They'll review the numbers. If they think it's giving customer acquisition, then they'll like commit full time to something. Because the all originals plan, I don't think it was doomed to fail. I don't think it has failed. They could carry on doing it. But I think there's clearly a way for them to accelerate subscriber growth if they do just get a catalog from somewhere.
Maybe this is a lingering effect of the strike too.
Possibly, yeah. Like this might be we know we don't have as much content as we wanted to during March and April, so we've just licensed some stuff for that to kind of pace us over. Because Argyle, like Napoleon Killers of the Flower Moon are now out, right? They're done and dusted. Argyle is in premium VOD at the moment, so it'll be streaming in March. But I don't think they'll have another film, like another big like hot, like drama film until the end of the year, or at least they haven't announced anything yet, so it's going to be probably like July time, at least based on
the
schedule as we know it now. Like they have a lot of like documentary films and smaller films on the schedule. Like they have a Steve Martin documentary coming out at the end of March and stuff, but like they don't have a Killers of the Flower Moon / Napoleon like epic big, you know, big blockbuster release scheduled until. The closest one I can think, like after Argyle comes out, the next one will be Wolves, and that's like coming to cinemas in like the late summer, like July, August time, which is Brad Pitt and George Clooney. So like, but between now and July, August, a bit bare on the film slate. So maybe this is their way of making up for that.
Since you complained about the TV app for just a second, I have a question for you. When did they change the behavior? So when you open the TV app, it defaults to the TV Plus tab.
I believe it defaults whichever tab you had open last.
Does it? I don't think... Let me test it here. I'll close TV Plus, or close TV.
That's how it's meant to work anyway.
Okay, I guess you're right. Maybe I just got stuck in a cycle or something, because it feels like every time I open it, it takes me to the TV Plus tab, even though I'm not actively watching anything on TV Plus.
You just end up always closing it on that tab.
I guess so. I open it, check out the main tab, scroll over to TV Plus, and say, oh, still nothing here that I want to watch. Close the app. That's probably...
See, I use the app so differently. I never go on any other tab.
I don't know how you do that.
Because I only use the app to watch TV Plus stuff that I'm interested in.
I guess I use it via the top row on the Apple TV homepage more than anything, just to quickly jump to the up next queue.
Yeah, you use it to continue stuff from other apps. Like you do like integration,
Hulu.
Right?
Yeah, Hulu integration.
Yeah, see, I don't bother with any of that stuff. I literally just use it like as if it was Netflix, just with a smaller library, right? Like, and I kind of wish they would let me use it more like that. Because I hate seeing I'm never going to buy or rent a film.
Well, buy Vision Pro, and then you'll be renting films quite a bit, so you can watch them in the TV environment. You know what I mean?
There's plenty of customers who are like, I'm paying my $10 a month subscription, just show me the stuff I'm actually paying for and nothing else. And that's how I use the TV app, and it falls down in many regards. They've got better at it. It used to be the case that every time you opened it, it would open on the first tab. And so I'd always have to change tab to get to the stuff that I actually want to see. And they didn't have the up next queue on that tab before. So like it's slowly getting better, but there's a million problems with it. But yeah, in theory, the way the TV app is meant to work, whatever tab you're on last is the one you come back to.
All right, I think that does it for this week. Again, as we talked about at the beginning, please consider joining 9to5 Mac Happy Hour Plus. You can go to 9to5mac.com/join. And you'll see all of the different plan options, $5 a month or $50 a year, ad-free episodes, bonus content, all of the good stuff.
And if you want to make us really happy, you can get 9to5 Mac Pro, which is the bundle which gives you daily and happy hour in one.
Indeed. $8 a month, $80 a year. A bargain. Send us feedback, happyhour@9to5mac.com. I am on Threads, Twitter, Mastodon, @ChanceHMiller. And Mayo, what about you?
@BZAMayo.
All right. Thanks, Mayo.
Bye-bye.